People think VC money is our money.
In the race to define Africa's financial future, one investor has quietly outperformed and outdelivered. They call him the Oracle of Capital.
China is a lot more capitalist than people think. The competition that exists within the Chinese market, you only see the champion.
Samson Esemwede, CFA. He started his career from Citi to Andoshi Bank and rose to become the vice president.
Mark Zuckerberg is privileged. Bill Gates is privileged. Femi Otedola is privileged. Aliko Dangote is privileged.
He is the mind behind Zrox Invest Management. Zrox isn't just betting on Africa's rise. They are building it.
I don't want to reduce success to a simple formula.
From Lemfi to Max.ng, not Motors, to Lafarge. Their fingerprints are on the continent's most defining ventures.
We live in a society where we equate monetary success to intelligence.
In this exclusive conversation, we go beyond spreadsheets and balance sheets into the psychology of wealth, the habits of billionaires, and the mysterious force of luck. How to expand the surface area of your opportunities.
We then become successful. We like to tell the world that this is the formula for success because we like to look down on people who are not successful to say they don't work as hard as we do. I think it's rubbish.
This is the story of an investor who believes Africa is in the next frontier. It is the frontier. This is the Frankly Business Podcast, where Africa's biggest minds come to talk money, business, and the future.
There's a reason why the Brits didn't want to let us go. We used to be a proud people.
The average age of an average African is 19. We hear this often, and what they say is that Africa is the next frontier. EM markets, emerging markets, Africa is one of those where a lot of investors think about investing. They're thinking of investing long-term, the next 10 years, the next 20 years. And the next continent they think of is Africa. Why? The age is in our favor. It's a fertile ground for your investment. But how true is this statement? That's what we're going to find out on this episode of the Frankly Business Podcast. You're very much welcome, Samson, to the Frankly Business Podcast. It's a rare privilege to have you here. Quick one, I want to ask you, what does Africa being the next frontier, what does it mean to you as regards investment?
I mean, this is something that we have spoken about for decades, right? Mm-hmm. When you look at the context of the global economy, Africa has 1.2 to 1.3 or 1.4 billion people.
Yeah.
But its contribution to global output is smaller than the contribution of the United Kingdom.
That's right.
Which has 60 or 70 million odd people, right? So when you look at the productivity gap that exists between African people and the Western and now their Asian counterpart, it's significant. It's huge. But when you look at the wave of development and the trend, right, you had the Western Renaissance.
Yeah.
And obviously China has also demonstrated quite remarkably that it's able to industrialize very, very quickly after the South East Asian nations. India is well on its way to being an industrial powerhouse. The only large market with large number of young people and geopolitics that would likely or is looking likely to favor the continent is Africa.
Mm.
Within the context of the global geopolitics between the West and Asia, I think, and also the rise, right, in basically unit labor cost in other manufacturing hubs, it's quite clear that there is a unique opportunity for Africa government and African businesses and African people. There's a lot of impediments, structural impediments and debottlenecking that we would need to do as a continent. And we can go into some of those details
please
during the course of this conversation. But those challenges are surmountable. I think we have something that the rest of the world doesn't have, which is a young, vibrant population. And basically, economic growth is a function of two things: number of people and the productivity of those people. We have the numbers. We need to work to ensure that those people are productive.
So you believe that Africans are not as productive as they should be?
The data tells you that they are not. I think the central problem of the African continent is a productivity challenge, right? And what drives productivity? It's education, it's infrastructure, and it's basically how you apply capital, right? And we are lagging behind across the board in terms of how productive our people are. Some of the analysis some people in my team do, right, is to compare productive capacity across industries, agriculture, industrials, and to benchmark that against our peers. So the Indonesias, the Malaysias of this world, or even other African countries like Kenya, Morocco, Egypt. And it's quite clear for Nigeria that we lag in the productivity curve. And in order for us to be able to grow, we need to close our productivity gap. So if I was to narrow the African challenge to one single word, it's productivity.
You're the chief investment officer of Zrox, and you invest heavily in startups. You broker deals. I love to call you the oracle of capital.
No. I haven't earned that. The only person, the only oracle I know is Warren Buffett. And he's done that over decades. And I've been able to show consistent return over a longer time frame.
Yeah.
We've only been around for 5.5-6 years. The returns have been decent and has been strong. But we haven't been through cycles to be confident or to be accepting of the word oracle. There's a lot of luck in investing, so I would just like to consider myself lucky.
There's a lot of luck in investing. I love that word. But what is the difference? A gambler, we say there's a lot of luck in gambling. You're an investor. You're saying there's a lot of luck in investing. What makes the difference between an investor and a gambler?
Interesting question.
Yeah.
And it's a very good one. So when you invest, right, you invest taking a view on the future, right? And oftentimes your view of the future tends to be linear, right? So for example, you can say, if I invest X amount of capital, this product can reach X amount of customers, and the unit economics of this product is Y. So if they can reach those customers, this is the value of what this product is going to earn. Yeah. And this is how I can decide how much I want to invest and the expected return over that period, right? These things happen in Excel spreadsheets. And I often say to my team that the greatest work of fiction is in Excel spreadsheets. Right? Because the world doesn't happen the way you see it. The world happens around a probability distribution, right? So while you have that one part that you've captured in your Excel, there are multiple other parts that are infinite that you need to consider.
Yeah.
What investing tries to do is to ensure that on a probabilistic basis, you are likely to be right than wrong. I'll give an example. If you toss a coin, that's gambling, heads or tail, right? It's a 50-50% chance of a heads or tail coming up. You can have a series of scenarios, right? Let's assume that I don't want to use this word because I don't want to upset people, but I hope I'm forgiving because I'll contextualize it. Let's assume I am God, right? And I'm able to see 100% of the future, right? And all the possible paths to the future.
Yeah.
What investing does is that if there is a high probability that your version of the future is going to crystallize, you take a view, right? It doesn't mean that the risk is that that version of the future doesn't crystallize.
Yeah.
So oftentimes when we invest, some of the work that we do is, and sometimes we invest and we make money. I always ask my team, I'm like, did we make money because of how we thought we were going to make money? Mm. Or did something else happen over the process, right? That gave us money and we look like geniuses, but really it's not what we were planning, right? So for example, I'll give an example. We're investors in the cement sector. So we have an investment in WAPCO, Lafarge,
wow.
Right?
Okay.
We did the work. We liked the company. But frankly, our central view, right, initially at the time when we made the investment, was really because we felt that the global, the macroeconomic disturbance that we had between 2023 and 2024 messed up the income statement of the company. And as exchange rate stabilizes, the underlying earnings of that business is going to become evident.
Very true.
Which played out partially, but then a few months after our investment, the company, there was an announcement by the main shareholder of the company, Holcim, that they were selling the business to the Chinese at a huge premium to the price we invested in.
Yeah.
I was happy because that's good return.
Very true.
But in reality, that was not my base case.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So that's why, like, to separate. So when you gamble, right, the odds are either even, or in most cases, if you go to the casino, they are skewed slightly in favor of the casino, right? Even if it's very little, when you run outcome scenarios over many, many times, very little numbers amplify into significant amounts of money. That's how casinos make money. That's their business model.
Yeah.
Investing, from my perspective, is ensuring that on a probabilistic basis, we are confident that our range of outcome is within the possible range of outcome that could then get realized in the future. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah. Absolutely. So if you've invested in Lemonade, you've invested in many startups, and you've been in boardrooms with billionaires. Yeah, I don't want to say, maybe I'm even sitting with one, by the way. But,
I invest people's money. So I'm not a billionaire. I'm just a fund manager.
Yeah. But we have fund managers and we have fund managers. So you've been in boardrooms with billionaires and all that.
Yeah.
Tell me about the billionaire habits. There are things we read in books. There are things you see. But you have first-hand experience with the movers and shakers of economy, using Africa as a a case study. Mm-hmm. What are the habits? And I'm saying this because there are conversations you hear. You hear them online. You see some things. Oh, you can't learn this. It's not free. You can't do this. You can't learn this from somebody. Nobody's going to tell you the real system or the real habits they formed that helped them over the years in becoming who they are. Mm. So the question now is, based on your relationship with investors across the length and breadth of Africa, what are the habits that you can tell our viewers that, hey, these are the things these guys do that make them who they are, that made them who they are?
To be honest, if I knew, I probably would write a book and sell it and it becomes a bestseller. So it's, I don't want to reduce success to a simple formula. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah.
However, we need to also understand that privilege plays a significant role in success outcomes, right? I'm not the most intelligent person in my secondary school, right? What I did have was a bit of intelligence, but I had access by virtue of the fact that my father made big sacrifices sending me to the UK to get educated. Mm-hmm. That gave me an advantage, right? And so that advantage, some people utilize, other people don't, right? So I think I utilize that advantage to get to where I am, where I am a co-founder of a company that is doing reasonably well, right? So I don't want us to downplay, right, privilege. The importance of privilege in success outcomes. Mark Zuckerberg is privileged. Bill Gates is privileged, right? Femi Otedola is privileged. Aliko Dangote is privileged. I think we live in a society where we equate monetary success to intelligence, right? It's not, there's some really intelligent, smart people who become successful in business, no doubt about that.
Yeah.
But I don't want to reduce, and obviously when we then become successful, we like to tell the world that this is the formula for success, because we like to look down on people who are not successful to say they don't work as hard as we do, right? I think it's rubbish, right? Mm. But what I see in successful people, and successful people can be billionaires, successful people can be employees, right? Successful people can even be your driver, right? What I see in successful people is a twinkle in the eye, right? In order to make something of whatever situation they find themselves, right? It's a growth mindset. It's the mindset that I am where I am today. Hmm. I will take the resources that I have to propel myself, right, into a future that is better, right? Some people have it, some people don't. And it's not a wishful growth mindset. It's an executable growth mindset, right? This is the cards life has dealt me. Some of us have been dealt good cards. Some of us have been dealt bad cards. But that idea that you improve your situation, like for example, I would respect somebody who comes from a no-name village, right? And ends up becoming a medical doctor, right? By great focus and work. Or someone who inherits $1 billion from his family network. It's a lot of work to keep money. I'm not trying to reduce that, yeah, that significance. And then grows it to, let's say, $5 billion, right? You've heard that the hardest thing to do in life is to make your first $1 million.
Yeah.
Once you get to that first $1 million, and then you get to 10, and then money grows, money compounds, capital accrues, right? So I'm not undermining or diminishing capitalists, because I'm one, right? But I think we need to have a society that is a bit more balanced as to what it takes to succeed. I think if we have a continual improvement mindset, regardless of the cards that Providence have dealt us, we will be successful, right? And that permeates across whatever you want to do, whether it's me trying to grow my business, or you as an employee trying to get promoted, or you in the village trying to move to the city and get a job as a cleaner or a driver. Mm-hmm. That continual improvement is why humanity has done so well. It's why we left our caves in the 50, 60,000 years ago. And it's why we are sending things to the moon, and why we think we can potentially communicate with aliens. Don't be static. The most successful people are not static. They are continually improving, continually seeking to get better. And they are people who take risk, right? Not gambling type of risk, but are willing to make, to take risks. So I often have a quote that the only decisions I regret in life are the ones I didn't take. Right? Any decision I have taken, good or bad, I've learned something from it, right? And it has allowed me to grow. Mm. So anytime I sit back, right, and I regret anything, it's often the decisions that I haven't taken, not the bad decisions I have made. I've made bad decisions. Everybody have, right?
You mind if you tell us some?
Oh, so I've lost money in the market quite significantly.
African market?
Global market, African market. I do money. I'm in the money business, yeah, right? So like,
what's your worst experience in investing?
I started my career during the global financial crisis between 2007, 2008, I worked for a global investment bank, at the time the largest bank in Europe, right? And I worked in the EM desk, right? Hmm. With significant level of risk across emerging markets. So from within this time zone, so from Russia to South Africa, we even had risk in Nigeria. And so I don't want to be too technical, because I don't have a sense of the audience, right? I think it's a broad audience that listens to the podcast. But I would try and simplify. When I started my graduate program and my graduate training, there are risk management models that you get trained on in terms of how to trade and how to manage EM and how to manage clients who manage EM money. There's one called the...
That's emerging markets.
Emerging
for those,
markets.
Yeah.
Emerging markets.
Yeah.
There's one called the value at risk model, right? For want of not being technical, that model estimates on a probabilistic basis what is the maximum loss your risk exposure can take on a daily basis, right? And being a chemist, like I have a chemistry background, so yeah. I am not a finance major. So I came from chemistry into banking,
yeah.
Right? I had unusual, because I thought finance was like science. An atom is an atom, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Finance is not like that. So finance shifts, finance changes, and estimations may not be true. Right.
Mm.
But in physics, right, a neutron is a neutron.
Yeah.
Right. Oxygen has, I can't remember, the hydrogen have one atom, one proton and one electron. It's a fact.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So those are facts until they are proven otherwise. Right. But they are scientific facts. Gravity is what gravity is.
Yeah.
In finance, it's not like that. But I came into finance with that mindset of mathematical models being as close to accurate as possible.
Hmm.
So I learned all the process, all the calculations, normal distribution, confidence interval stuff. And we had this VAR model that basically told us that, okay, there's on a 99% confidence interval, right? For want of not being too technical, so in the history of those financial assets, 99% of the time, they've never lost more than X. Right?
To
oversimplify.
Yeah, that's right.
So in my head, I was like, okay, that makes sense. And then the Lehman happened. Lehman Brothers.
Lehman Brothers, yeah. Right. 2008.
And for 8 straight days, what I thought could only happen 1% of the time in the life of those financial instruments, our VAR model was breached 8 days in a row. If you put that in a statistical model, that is probably once in a 14 billion outcome. The world has not existed for that long, right?
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So for me, it was an education on how wrong we can be about assumptions that we put into decision-making that has stuck with me throughout my investing career. I am a super cynical person, and my team will tell you most of the time I spend thinking, how wrong can we be? Why do you think your assumptions are correct? Why do you think your assumptions are accurate?
Mm.
Is there anything, like my partner used to say something when we have meetings. He was like, you can't argue with facts, but you need to be very cynical about assumptions, right? That is the DNA of our company, right? We question assumptions unless you are able to prevent on a factual basis why you think something is the way it is.
Yeah.
The moment you assume, somebody, even the intern, will ask you why.
Hmm. Is this similar to, you're saying even the intern will ask you why? Is this similar to the concept of, if you really understand something and you can't explain it to a 7-year-old, why you're wrong or right? Is it similar to that?
Yeah. So I think maybe because I'm a scientist and my partner is an engineer, right? That's our background, and we brought that into finance. We have a first principle. We try and understand things from first principle.
Yeah.
Economics and finance have a lot of rules, right? Some of those rules were developed in economic environments that are completely different from the one that we are living in.
True.
Right? But sometimes people think that those rules would apply in places like Nigeria. And when they don't, they, instead of questioning their understanding of the economic environment, they just say, oh, nothing works in Nigeria. It is not true that nothing works in Nigeria. It's that the model that you are applying to Nigeria doesn't approximate the reality of Nigeria. So you are getting bad outcomes, right? So what we encourage, right, within our organization is a first principle understanding of anything that you are doing.
What is the first principle understanding?
So it's basically what's, I don't want to be too technical, but it's basically what drives these underlying assumptions, right? Why do we have these assumptions here, right? Why do I understand why if interest rate goes up, inflation comes down, What are the mechanisms that drives those? And are those mechanisms within the context of Nigeria in play? And if they are, what are they? And if they are not, what are the substitutes? What are the alternatives? It's almost applying a process engineering scientific mindset to the concept of investing, right? Because what are we trying to do as investment managers? We are trying to predict the future and hope that our prediction of the future is right.
Yeah.
Right? That's what we are trying to do. So if you get it wrong, nobody is going to say the models that you built were so sophisticated. People are just going to say, well, he lost a lot of money. And the longer you lose a lot of money, you lose a lot of your clients and you don't have business anymore.
Yeah,
right?
True.
So our job, given that we try to approximate the future, is that we have a good, you will never get 100% sense. There's always room for errors. There's always room for mistakes. But we try as hard as we can, right, to ensure that our view of the world is as close to reality as possible. And that's what I mean by first principle understanding.
Investing, if you look at Africa, and you made mention of the fact that we need to examine every decision we take and get it right from the first principle.
Mm-hmm.
But FDIs, look at foreign direct investment coming into Africa and using Nigeria as a case study, it looks like a lot of capital that comes in, they don't contextualize investment. They take the Silicon Valley approach and bring it into Nigeria, into Africa in general.
Yeah.
Now, let's use the startup ecosystem as a case study.
Mm.
You hear this company, I think it was in 2024, my first show, because I host a business show on international television.
Yeah.
I remember one time then, I deliberately, we had like 5 seconds silence for 5 startups that went down the drain in less than 6 months.
Why?
Some you hear co-founders conflicts, you hear some unresolved conflicts, you hear different cases and issues.
Yeah.
But the question now is, what do you think is happening to the African startup ecosystem? A lot of startups going down the drain, raising millions and millions of dollars, pre-seeds.
Yeah.
And I'm asking you this question because you've invested in Lemonade, you've invested in Lemonade Finance. And
Lemfi.
Yeah, Lemfi. Yeah. And you've invested in, you were one of the investors in Max.
Yeah.
You just said you invested in WAPCO and you've done this a number of times.
Yeah.
What is the underlying problem?
Yeah.
Let's treat it from the first principle.
Yeah. Okay. So Africa needs a lot of new businesses. Africa needs a lot of new ideas, right? And I think one of the things we need to do as a society is to encourage our young people to start businesses. And we need to build an ecosystem that ensures that it supports that those businesses and those businesses can scale. But business operates within an economic reality, right? The economic reality of Africa, right, is that we are relatively a small economy with a lot of people, right, spread over a huge amount of landmass, right, and with differing cultures, right? So the markets are not integrated. The markets are segmented by barriers, right? Political barriers, ethnic barriers. So when you are building, you need to build with that framework in mind, right? I think a lot of mistakes that were made in the post-COVID period was to look at places like India, which is a bit more coherent, or Brazil, which is a bit more coherent, and apply the same lens to Africa as a whole, right? What that does is that you start to overestimate your market potential. And by doing that, you also end up paying or valuing your ideas much bigger than the reality of what that idea can achieve.
Yeah.
So within our venture business, for example, I'll fire anybody who uses the word unicorn, right?
Mm.
We are not looking for unicorns. We are not interested in unicorns. If we invest in a business, I think Lemfi could potentially well become a billion-dollar company. But we didn't invest because it was going to be a billion-dollar company. We basically saw a product, right, and paid a valuation that we thought was fair at the time when we made the investment on very conservative assumptions that this business can be a $50 to $100 million company. That is the lens within venture that we use to look at opportunities. Because while the economy of Africa, in my opinion, as it is today, because you have to build for the current reality.
Sure.
You are also building for the future, but there's a lot of pipe dream and assumptions and Excel models that paint this rosy future that may or may not happen.
Hmm.
You need to really, in order for you to really make money, you need to really consider your economic reality. When you have a total economy that is between $2 to $3 trillion in size, right? That's divided over 1.2, 1.3 billion people.
Yeah.
It's not a big economy, right?
Mm.
And then the euphoria around everybody wanting to build a billion-dollar business is a pipe dream, because ultimately the value of a company is the present value of its future discounted cash flow, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you have that economic size, that, I mean, the economy will grow, and the reason why you're investing is that you should ensure the economy will grow,
yeah,
right? But if your economic size is such that it cannot realistically support the number of billion-dollar companies that people are deploying checks for, are you then surprised that businesses are struggling with the concept of scale, right? And it's interesting, right? Because one of the things that I used to find really annoying,
yeah,
with startup founders is they come to you, right? And they say, Nigeria is a fantastic market. I agree, right? They tell you 200 million people. I agree. I need to raise $500,000 to basically scale this product, move it from an MVP to version one,
yeah,
and drive customer acquisition, right? So you're like, okay, interesting idea. And then the moment you get to maybe 500K or 400K of revenues, you want to open a new country. You want to be in Ghana. You want to be in Kenya. I'm like, no. You have to be able to export competitive advantage. You are trying to survive in your first market, right? You are trying to deepen your moat. And the cost of capital and all the input variables that drive your success within the context of Nigeria is on average higher than the rest of other places.
Yeah.
So you carry that, you haven't dominated your own market, and then you are now introducing complexity into your business by going to open in Ghana, going to open in Kenya. Because anytime you do that, in my mind, you are basically telling me that you don't believe that the market that you came to pitch to me has the capacity to deliver the returns that you initially told me I was going to get.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So you think that we should start exporting, founders need to start thinking of ways to service the rest of the world rather than spreading their tentacles across Africa?
So, I mean, our growth model needs to be mixed, right? I'm always very wary. I don't have magic bullets, right? Mm. I am what you call a reiterator, right? So I try something. If it doesn't work, I try something else. We need to think about our growth model. What I'm saying, right, within the context of founders and the struggles and why a lot of businesses failed,
yeah,
is number one, they overestimated their business potential.
Yeah.
So they raised money at valuations that were wrong, right? Instead of raising money at a low valuation. Because during the 2001-2002 period,
yeah,
you will see people with zero revenue valuing their businesses at $20 million, $30 million. And I often tell them, right, I'm like, your value is what you put on it. I'm not following you to argue the concept of value.
Brand equity.
Right, I'm not following you to argue the concept of value. The problem, yeah, however, is when you start with that level of high jump, my expectation of you in terms of operating performance is more than somebody that decides to value his business at $2 million. For a $2 million business, $200,000, $300,000 revenue run rate is acceptable.
Yeah.
For a $30 million business, you need to be doing $3, $4, $5 million for that valuation to be justified. So why do you start there? Why don't you start with the two or the three, right? Don't raise as much as you want to raise if you're afraid of dilution. Use that to prove that you're getting a bit of momentum and then raise at a higher valuation later. Why do you want to start your journey? Or like my father used to say, why do you want to build your house from the ceiling?
But a lot of people say that the pressure, I've had a founder and we were having this conversation and she categorically said that some of this pressure comes from the VCs. Come from the investors. So they put a pressure on you for you to perform.
Mm-hmm.
And they raise the bar so high
mm-hmm.
that it looks unattainable
mm-hmm.
and fault you for not hitting that, for not reaching that.
When they were giving you the capital, what valuation did they give you the capital at? If I gave you money at a $1 million valuation, my expectation of you is different if I gave you money at a $30 million valuation. If you come and say, $30 million, you're a rock star, I'll say, no problem, right? Mm. But I need you to be at $3 million revenue in 18 months. I have to be able to justify, because oftentimes people forget, people think VC money is our money.
Yeah, I think you need to explain that part. So people understand the concept. Can we take it back to how the business works.
Yeah.
The monies you invest in startups.
Yeah.
Where does it come from?
Yeah.
How do you get that capital?
Yeah.
How do you distribute the capital and all that? Yeah.
People have different business models, but I will try and summarize in a generalized way.
Yeah.
Right. So most VC exists within what they call a GPLP structure.
Okay.
Right. So the GP is usually the founder. So in this case, will be me. Right. I think there's a huge opportunity in Africa. I think there's a huge opportunity in Nigeria. Right. I go to asset allocators. These asset allocators are either the development finance institutions like the DPIs of this world, Afrexims of this world, or
AFDB.
University AFDBs of this world, or the university endowments, so Harvard endowments. Or rich people, family offices. You can go to Dangote's family office, or you can go to, and you say, I think there's a huge opportunity here, right? I need capital to be able to take advantage of this opportunity, and I will promise you a return on that capital over, typically, it's around a 7-year. I have a problem with the structure, but we can come to that.
Yeah.
But within the context of Africa, it's usually, most funds will be like a 5-year, 7-year period. And the expectation is that when they agree, usually as a GP, you have like 5% of your money, in some cases higher, in the fund, right? And then everybody else invests as a limited partner. They're just capital providers.
Okay.
They put that capital into a pool, but you have promised them a return. Because if you don't achieve those returns, what happens is that you can't raise your next fund, right? Mm. So your own very business survival, right, is predicated on your ability to deploy that capital effectively and earn a decent economic return.
Yeah,
I'll put things in context. Most funds will tell you they would deliver you 20% IRR, right? I don't like the word. I mean, IRR is something that's been abused in the industry. But for simplicity, right, it's basically saying that, okay, for the time that your capital is with me, I will compound 20% return on that capital over the life of that capital.
Okay.
So to put things in context, if it's a 5-year fund, right?
Yeah.
It means that by the, and if I'm able to deliver 20% IRR, over a 5-year period, roughly, because I don't have a calculator with me, I should basically return between 3 to 4 times the money that you give
me
over a 5-year period. That is a high jump, right? That is what drives me. That is the pressure that my venture book is under, right? So that capital is not free capital. That I'm giving you, because my own very business survival is based on, firstly, I earn a percentage of that capital every year, usually 2%, right? 1%, 2%. And then I earn what you call a carry, right? Which is basically the profit I make on that capital, right? So my ability to survive as a business and to hire the best analysts and to pay them really good bonuses and to continue to be successful is based on my ability to obviously grow my capital base, all right, which is driven by success, and end at 20% carry, right? If I can't do that, I'm out of business. So that's my business model. And that's the business model that I then use to face the founders, right? So oftentimes, like, people have slightly different structures. And within the context of Africa, because of how behind we are, then these 5-year, 7-year fund structures are often not long enough to realize value for those unit holders. So there are structural deficiencies in this Silicon Valley model that we've imported into Nigeria and think it will work. So for example, I'm not a big fan of life cycles for venture capital investments, for example.
Why?
I think you need to have a fresh thinking, right? Around capital duration, right? Like, for example, I would think the way the ecosystem is structured, we probably need more permanent capital vehicles, right, that are able to build bolt-on businesses and do an IPO of those businesses and return dividend and income distribution to investors.
Yeah.
The challenge with cash distribution or closed-end 5-year funds, right, is that, for me, is either you increase the length of time of those funds,
okay,
right, or you make it permanent, right? But people,
permanent?
Yes. Okay. But you earn money from the growth in the market perception of the net asset value of those vehicles, right? So it's not like you don't return the capital. You return the capital, but just the way a company on the stock exchange behaves.
Yeah, true.
Right? GT Bank is a permanent capital vehicle that invests in banking assets, basically.
True.
Right? So you make your money from the dividend and the capital appreciation in GT Bank.
Yeah.
I think that startup ecosystem within the context of Africa may need to think about structures like that. And the reason why is, number one, is I spoke to the concept of smaller markets, right? So your exit opportunities are not these $1 billion opportunities that people think. But there's nothing wrong with investing at $2 million and selling at $50 million. You might not be able to do all of that within a fund. Number two, because of how early you are starting this thing, it takes a lot more time for businesses to achieve scale, right? And then you are put under a lot of pressure, right, to achieve that scale very quickly. That's when you move fast and break things when you shouldn't really be doing that, right? So obviously the VC capital model for Silicon Valley has worked magic in the United States. But we have to remember that United States also sits on top an infrastructure that is way more advanced than we have, right? So for example, think about an Amazon. Amazon exists because of US Post. Mm. If you didn't have the US Post infrastructure, you wouldn't have Amazon today. And Amazon equivalent in Africa would need to build that infrastructure. You can't build that infrastructure in 7 years.
Hmm.
So that's the difference.
Yeah, true.
Right. So if you don't think that, Jumia is not scaling as fast, it cannot. Firstly, I have to cover a much wider geography, right? I'm dealing with last mile infrastructure that doesn't exist. I don't even know where people stay, if where they stay is the right place. I'm just using e-commerce as an example.
Yeah.
So that model won't work, right? It cannot work. So if I go and then invest in a Jumia or an Amazon-like company within the context of a VC fund, na long thing be that.
So if you look at other parts of the world where capital has worked and where you think that, which model do you think we can mirror that is closely related to that of Africa? China? India?
Yeah, I mean, the Chinese have done a remarkable job
of
incubating businesses. They've done it, right, by basically is a government led privately facilitated startup ecosystem, right?
I love that. Right, can you take that again?
it's a government led privately facilitated growth engine. Mm. What do I mean by that, right? It just sounds like grammar. So the way these Chinese are is, the way their politics is structured, you have the guy at the top, right? And that guy says, you know what, in 10 years, I think China should be the best TV maker in the world, right? That's all he says. Doesn't do anything else. All of a sudden, the provincial guy in Guangzhou calls his ICE automaker, say, Oga have said we need to do EV.
Which is equivalent to governor.
Yeah, which is equivalent to governor, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, and we need to do EV. What are you doing about it? What do you need? Because that guy, governor, knows that in order for him to get promoted in the party system, he needs to generate that EV company. So he goes to the gas maker saying that the big man has said EV, I don't want my province to be behind.
Yeah.
What are you doing to do EV? That one will now come. Right, and Obasanjo did this with Dangote. So, right, that one will now come and say, okay, for me to do EV, I need capital. I need this. I need that. I need this, right? What then happens is you then start your own EV. But Governor B is not happy that you have started your own EV. So he calls his own guy, right? Saying that guy has started his own EV. So all of a sudden, you have 140 EV companies that just get born overnight. It's not a VC system. It's a different system. Sometimes people often forget. They say, oh, China allocates capital and chooses the winners. So 140 people, you have a billion market, go and kill yourself, right? So they go in, right? They compete, right? Properly, internally, in that market. People, some die, some don't survive, some swallow the other ones. Then the BYD will now come out of that fight. So you go through a hunger game of capitalism and competition. So I said something during one of my Nairametrics articles when I said China is a lot more capitalist than people think. And I got a lot of pushback. This is what I was trying to articulate, but I didn't say it long enough. The podcast wasn't long enough for me to have this conversation. I'm like, the competition that exists within the Chinese market, you only see the champion. So when the champion shows up, right, he has fattened up from the fight, right? Right? And then he's able to take on the world. So that's why BYD is able to deliver better vehicles with better performance and cheaper price than Tesla can. What the US will say is that, okay, we want to do EVO, throw as much money into Tesla as possible, give them as much subsidy as possible. Obviously, that lends itself to corruption and all those kind of stuff.
True.
Right? I'm not saying the China system is corruption free. It's not, but it's a lot more competitive. And success in my head, I'm not ideological in terms of political systems, right? I like democracy because it gives me the opportunity to get rid of bad people, right? That's the only thing I like about democracy. But what society needs is the ability for the best people to compete at the very top. How do we create a system that ensures our best people are our champions? Right. You can do it in a democratic system if everybody is very well informed, very well educated. You can do it. Or, right, you can do it in a China type of system that allows best ideas and allows competition. And then the big guys. So that's why when you see the Chinese, the guys that you face in China, they've been through an internal war. You're facing the best of the best of the Chinese. So are you surprised that they are messing with the rest of the world the way they are messing with the world? It's not a surprising thing. That's their own model. Right? I think it's an admirable model. I'm not saying Nigeria should copy it. We should look at our own history. Right? And figure out what has worked for us in the past. This is a society of great empires. We had the Benins, right? We had the Kanem-Bornuns, right? We had the Oyos. These were civilizations. How did we do things that got us to that acclaim before we had this 400 years of bastardization that was slavery and colonialism? We need to think about the growth model that worked for Africa, right? And it requires a lot of philosophical thinking. It requires a lot of introspection. Frankly, I think it requires therapy because we need to get away from the mental block that slavery and colonialism has created for our people.
So that's a lot to take in. That's a lot to take in, honestly, because it just further crystallizes the idea that there is more to the result than what we see.
Yeah.
Because we always see China as the manufacturing hub of the world, not knowing that the guys who are exporting to the rest of the world have gone through a series of battles before being unveiled. It's more or less like
battle tested.
Yeah, more or less like Olympics.
Yeah.
So do you think, I know you have a likely solution for the African continent.
I don't too.
Which model do you think is most likely going to work? Do you think we should take that hook, line, and sinker?
No.
We always,
this democratic system that the West has imported and given us to run.
You feel it's not the best?
Well, we have experimented on it since independence, and it's not worked, right? And insanity is doing the same thing over and again and expecting a different result. We can have systems that have elements of democracy. My priority, economically speaking, I'm not talking from the perspective of political freedom, et cetera, et cetera. That's a separate conversation.
Very true.
But when I think about it from an economic perspective, is how do we build a system where our best people thrive? Today, that's not the case in Nigeria. Who is thriving? The rentopreneurs, right? It's basically somehow we've built a society where when you are growing up, right, there are some guys that are at the back of the class, noisemakers, and everybody doesn't take them seriously. The girls don't like them. They don't take their school seriously. And you are like, oh, these people are just doomed to fail. And then fast forward 20 years, 30 years, they are governors. What kind of society is that?
Whoa.
Meanwhile, the guy that's got a parallel and you should be funding his idea on how to take on and elevate Nigeria, that guy cannot even find work. Or the best ones leave the country because they are frustrated by the place. So we've created a system that negatively selects our worst people to lead us. And then we look back and say, we are not moving forward. It's a joke now. So we really need to go back and introspect on the sort of society we want to be. If this is what it is, and then everybody will vote with their feet, right? The ones that are really, really good, we go and contribute their skills elsewhere. And this is what we are seeing. The guy who came first in class, like in my secondary school chat, right? I think they're probably about, like, let me just assume, like 200 people in the chat.
Hmm.
Of those 200 people, about maybe 20 of them are doctors. Right. I look through the chat. There's no single Nigerian number of the doctors. They are all abroad contributing their skills to other people's society because we've built a society that completely marginalizes them.
Hmm. So is this a system problem?
Yeah, systemic. Yes. Yeah,
how absolutely. Can it be solved?
Again, it's good question. I don't have easy answers, right?
If
I
had tell us the hard ones.
If I have easy answers, then yeah, it will be easy. I would just say do this and this. But I don't have easy answers. But I think again, it's a leadership issue. But then the question is, how do you effect leadership change when the leaders are benefiting from a system that is suboptimal? Right.
Hmm.
It's a challenge. It's a big, 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 big problem. So you need either, you need, like, I often say, right? Because, like, I don't like this concept of revolution.
Yeah.
Because nothing good comes out of it. Like, the whole place, very rare. I mean, there are only few, maybe the French Revolution was successful. Mm-hmm. But usually, what happens in Nigeria is competition for power and influence. So the people who are leading the revolution, they are leading the revolution because they've been cut out of the national cake.
Yeah.
So, right? And then, And then when they now become in power, they become even worse than the people, or sometimes lives are lost, properties are lost. As a capitalist, I don't like that. Right?
Yeah, true.
So I don't want that. I think oftentimes what brings about change is competing influence within elite circles, right? So I look at the UK, for example, which is, or like almost like my second home country, because that's where I got educated and where I got my professional experience before I came back to Nigeria. And I asked myself, how did the UK become developed, right? How did we go through this journey that we see the society? Obviously, there's a part of it where we went to go and basically rape everywhere in the world, right? But we don't like to say that out loud,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
But there's also the part where they could have raped everywhere in the world, and then the UK elites would just keep into their pocket, and you won't see any development.
True.
That could have happened.
You're correct, yeah. Right?
Why did we see development? Why did we see? It's a good question to ask. I think what happened, right, was you had the aristocracy,
yeah,
right, which is the kings and the dukes and the whatever, right? The aristocracy, being aristocrat, they didn't want to be the merchants. They didn't want to be the one going to India and going to loot the place. Or they didn't want to be the one going to Africa and going to loot the place. So they sent below aristocrat type of people. But when those guys turned up in India, they created unimaginable wealth. In order to protect that wealth, they were like, I can't bring all this money back so that the king and his boys will come and take it.
Yeah.
Right? We need to create a system that is fairer. How do I do it? Let me go to Stratford. All those below proletariat is the word they use for them. All those people. Let's create a system that is fair. Let's advocate for democracy so that we can check the power of this monarch.
Yeah.
Right? And that's what now brought, so obviously the king, there was a war and the king lost, right? And then they're like, okay, how do we create a fair system? That's how parliament was created. That's how we then have a democratic system that represented individual rights. So it's out of elite self-interest that brought UK development, in my view, right? We need to have an elite group, right? Because elites are the ones that have resources. I know people hate that word, right? Because of how bad our elites have been.
Yeah, true.
Right? But elites are the ones that have the resources. They are the ones that at least police will be afraid to arrest when wahala comes.
Yeah, true.
Right?
True.
Right? And so you need to have enough elite incentive to say, you know what? Let us have a system that works. What does that mean? You need to tie elite success to a functioning system. That's not what we have today. Most of the people we call elites, firstly, got their money in government. And government basically got their money from oil rent up until recently that things are changing a little bit. So those guys, Nigeria could be burning for all I care. Their pocket continues to get lined. Why do they care? But when you now have people who are entrepreneurs, the Aliko Dangotes of this world, you think Aliko, right, for all his monopolistic behavior that people talk about, do you think the guy will let Nigeria burn?
Never.
He can't now. So imagine you have 10 of them, 20 of them, 50 of them. Then they start to think, for self-preservation, my wealth, my source of influence is this society.
True.
So I need to do whatever I need to do to protect this society. So again, like, it sounds a bit more, I don't like to be accused of elitist thinking, right? I just, I'm not confident that popular uprising, popular revolution will bring the change that Nigeria desires. It is why things like this competition, I mean, for all your conversations, I don't want to say political things, but having this Peter Obi movement, having, in the end of the day, it adds to elite decision making. Because even Tinubu, for all his strength and power, and he's done a lot of good things, to be fair, and bad things, but economically, I think he's done.
We're going to go into that.
He's looking behind his back now, because there's a competing alternative that is saying that if you mess up, I'm happy to take your position. So what we need is elite competition, and we need to figure out a system that engineers it. It's not a vote of confidence that Obi is competent. I don't know.
Yeah.
Right? But what he does is that he provides an alternative that he points to that even keeps the incumbents on their toes. Society benefits from that type of competition.
Wow. That's a lot. That's a lot to go in. But I would also love to talk about this current administration and the Nigerian economy. Let's start with the Nigerian economy at large. It's been Nigeria go better. A mentor of mine would always say he doesn't like that phrase. Like, if everything you're working on is anchored on that statement, one day you go better. Sorry, not Nigeria. If he asks you, okay, what are you doing? And you say, oh man, I'm just getting by. One day you go better.
My church, and mosque, of course. Yeah.
So that one day you go better thing is the only thread holding 200 million people. And a lot of Nigerians are beginning to lose their grip of that thread. you're losing hope.
Mm-hmm.
And hope is like, if you lose hope,
society, there's nothing. It's anarchy, right?
It's anarchy. There's nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think is happening to the Nigerian economy? I'll give you, you go to the market, you have an idea, even if you go to the supermarket or you go to the random market, you find out the price of something, you seldom see commodity price go down in Nigeria, right from when I was small. What is happening? I understand that it happens in other...
But that's global, right?
That's global.
It's just the pace that's different.
The pace, exactly. The pace. What's happening?
Yeah.
And let us talk about how we can fix the Nigerian economy.
Yeah. You're asking me very difficult questions. And I don't like to provide simple answers, right? Okay, let's... The truth of the matter, right, is since independence, we have not been a serious country.
Yeah.
Right. That's the truth. We tried during the very early days, right?
Yeah.
Because think about it. When we had independence, the South Koreans, the Malaysians, the Indonesians, in terms of income per capita, were the same level as us. Today, we are not even mates. We are like, what, 600 naira income per capita, $600 income per capita. These guys are in the tens of thousands.
Yeah.
Right? So we are like, how did they gap us that much? Right? We have never articulated an economic plan, at least a sustained one that is believable. And then on top of that, we've then had a cacophony of terrible leadership outside of Obasanjo, quite frankly. Hmm. Everything else had been a mess, right? And then the worst of them all was the one before this one, right? Because that one basically turned economics in its head, which is why when the Ashiwaju government came, and I always say, like, because when I talk about this government, it's almost like I support them. I speak purely from an economic perspective. It's not a political one.
Yeah.
Right. Political choices are private.
Yeah, true.
But they came, right? And I think Nigerians don't understand how messed up our economy was, right? And the level of distortion that was in the economy, right? You had PMS prices that were low, right? Which a few people benefited from. Most of it were people exporting products to other countries and people basically just collecting rent from NNPC. NNPC had, as at last year, had 7.4 trillion in liabilities. Do you think Nigerian benefited from that? He just fed a few people fat, right? The same thing with exchange rates. Market was clearing at 750. Hmm. Central bank was selling to preferred people at 350 or 360 or 450, whatever that rate is. If you are Aliko Dangote, right, and they give you exchange rate at 360, and you can go and sell it the next day for 750.
I will not do business.
Why will you do business? How many cements do you think that man has to sell in a year to be able to make that kind of margin?
Hmm.
You get what I'm saying? So the economy was distorted, and that distortion fed through, right? And you had chronic imbalances. Another problem is when you have exchange rate that is too strong, you start importing everything. Right? Because there's something called inflation parity in economics, which is basically your exchange rate is supposed to weaken by the difference between your inflation and that of your trade partners. So if you assume our trade partner is mainly China and the US, for the sake of argument, it's more complex than that. And they have inflation of 2-3%, and you have inflation of 15%. Your exchange rate is supposed to at least weaken by 13%. If it doesn't happen, what happens is that your input price goes up by that amount. So your goods, relative to them, becomes a lot more expensive.
True.
Right? And that's why it then makes sense for you to import. That's why you get this import dependency that people talk about.
But it's also linked to the non-productivity.
Yes, right. So, but the non-productivity is also a function of this. Because like your exchange rate also determines, gives you a platform to be productive, because you can then produce goods and services that you can export, or like at least it's competitive enough that import doesn't compete with it.
Yeah, true.
So the point I'm trying to make is that these guys inherited a mess. The fiscal finances were a joke. I mean, Godwin printed like 30 trillion naira. Printing, right? We are still dealing with that today. Today, the liquidity in the system is more than the productive activity that happens in the economy. When that happens, it creates massive distortions in the economy. Your money supply, right, in economics is supposed to grow roughly, right, by your nominal GDP.
But it's with fuel. Some people have the argument that it's with just pockets of
But the liquidity doesn't move. The liquidity is in the banking system. Mm. Most of it has gone back to the central bank and the politicians through the debt that they've accrued over the years. So we've built an economic system that just hovers value from the rest of us into people that maybe are not up to 1 million. If you add all the people that are running rackets in Nigeria, I'm not sure they are up to 1 million.
Not at all.
So, but we've basically built a system. It's almost like a Hoover that just takes value from everybody else and then distributes that value to very, very few people. Right? How are we different from the Yoruba guys that came 400 years ago to come and steal our brothers and sisters? Right? It's even worse. The people that are stealing us look like us.
yeah.
At least the other one, you can say, this one is normal. But like we basically inherited an economic system from the Westerners.
Very true.
We didn't re-engineer it. We just put our own people on top of it and we ran with the same system. So the point I'm saying is, like, it's easy to blame this government. It's easy to blame Ashiwaju, but he came and he met a mess, right? And there's argument to be made that when they came, I'm not sure they were prepared for the mess that they saw. Which is why the initial period was very painful. Like, the process of liberalizing the exchange rate without properly going through the detail, right, of why we had those imbalances, right? It's only until Cardoso came, we started to address those issues. So there was a loss of confidence in the economy. Hmm. That was when Naira went to 1,800. We didn't need to be there.
Yeah.
You can blame that partially on government execution capacity. But what this government has done, to be fair on them, is they have removed a lot of structural impediments that has hamstrung our growth for as long as I've been looking at this market, and it's a long time. The only person that have done anything close to what these guys are doing is Olusegun Obasanjo during the 1999 to 2003 period. So he's setting us up, I think, for growth, right? Time will tell, right? You have argument, I don't want to speak about his politics.
Yeah.
And like, you are worried that he consolidates power, he never gives it back. And what is happening in Lagos will happen in Abuja. I don't know. And I don't have the expertise to comment on that. But purely from an economic standpoint, PMX subsidy is gone, right? Exchange rates, if you can argue, is weak, but at least you are buying the same rate that Dangote is buying exchange rate at.
So it makes it a fair game.
So it's a fair game. I can compete. I'm not going to having to figure out, like in the past, in order for you to get FX, you're figuring out who knows somebody in CBN. Even Gateman in CBN was running racket on exchange rates. Now, go to market and buy. There's no favorable price. That predictability drives economic activity, in my view. So they've done a fine job there. On government finances, and so that's something that people don't really talk much about.
Yeah.
There've been significant improvements in consolidated finances for Nigeria. What I mean by that is, when people talk about debt that government is incurring, they always just talk about federal debt. But that's not the government. The government is federal, state, and local government. And state and local government together, right, spend close to 50% of total government expenditure. But we say, government has deficits, but state is in a surplus. Revenues of states have doubled since 2003. And governors, states tend to spend up to 60% of what they earn in capital projects. They spend more, unlike the federal guys that do more recurrent projects, right? So there's a lot of capital project that is happening. You can argue around the efficiency of that spend.
Yeah, true.
Right? Obviously, cronyism and all those kinds of things, I'm not disputing that.
Yeah.
But at least money is being spent, roads are being built, schools are being renovated, things that impact productivity in the long run, for the first time since Obasanjo left, is being tackled. Right? So from an economic perspective, how do you score a government like this poorly? The issue, however, is that it hasn't gone down to the real economy yet.
So the transmission mechanism is what is the underlying issue of all this conversation. Because if we have economists, people like you always say, we have the transmission mechanism from policy to implementation to feeling the impact is so slow. Let's take a look at what is happening with interest rates. As of last year, double digits. What am I even saying? It's been double digits for like years. Yeah, but it went to as high as almost 30%, 30 something percent. And all of a sudden we saw some kind of, let me use the words of the common man. They say some manipulation because that's what they see it. That's what they see it as. The Nigerian Bureau of Statistics did regarding MBS, to bring inflation down and having to tamper with the figures through reducing the base, GDP, inflation, rebasing and all that. Do you think that there's some manipulation regarding the rebasing? Was it needed? Or have our markets really experienced drop in the prices of commodities?
Okay. Societies rebase GDP all the time. It's just the way it works because it's a survey, right? So you do a survey at a particular point.
It's suspicious.
And your economic activity changed. For example, during the last GDP, we didn't have content creators. Right. How do you capture content creators? You need to kind of introduce them into the data set.
True.
Right? I'm just using that as an example. So the whole process of rebasing itself is not foul play.
Okay.
What I have is the timing. When you are executing a reform, don't introduce data that confuses people even more. Right. And that's the issue I'm having with inflation. Because people always forget that inflation is a persistent rise of goods and services. So if it's a price of something goes from 100 to 200, inflation is 100%. If it goes from 200 to 300, inflation is 50%. So inflation has decelerated, right?
Sure.
So sometimes people are expecting that, prices need to come down. Prices doesn't need to come down for inflation to slow. Prices just need to stop rising as fast as they were rising before, right?
Yeah.
So in that context, do I think prices are rising less than they were rising before? I think absolutely. It's not manipulation. The pace, the degree is what is being debated. And what has created this debate is this January statistic that they went to go and introduce.
True.
Right? They would have just left the old series, or they would have run the old series and the new series side by side each other so that we can start to then draw a trend before you then exit the old series and bring the new series in. So I don't really think it is manipulation.
Okay.
I'm sure there are people that will try to manipulate, no doubt. Like some people just, there are different types of people. There are some people that by hook or crook, they want to produce a number.
Yeah, true.
I don't like to take that view. I like to say, okay, was there a legitimate basis for a rebasing? Yes. Was the timing wrong? I think so. But I also think if you strip out the data, we are in a decelerating inflationary environment. What is being debated is that the pace of price deceleration, right, or reduction in rate of price increase is not as fast as we would like it to be, which is what affects this transmission mechanism that you talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm hoping, right, economic reform takes time more, right? Usually, when you go through this process, it's a 3 to 5 year period before you start to see any real material benefits in per capita income growth.
Yeah.
It is, right? And we are, 2 years in, going to our third year. So I won't write it off yet that the common man won't feel the benefits. There are industries that have been opened up, right? Oil and gas has basically been reopened. They will need to hire a lot of people across the spectrum. Transport has basically reopened. They will need to hire a lot of people across the spectrum. Even maritime, right? They will need to hire a lot of people across the situation. Businesses that have been through tough times are repairing their margins now. But once they repair their margins, they need to grow, they need to expand, they need to invest in capacity. So what has happened really is when this administration came out, again, I repeat, I'm not an advocate for this administration because that can be very confusing. When this administration came, Nigeria was basically a patient in its deathbed, right? That was bleeding from the aortic artery, which is what we say, a very significant artery that you die, right? Yeah. What these guys have done, right? I've said, okay, let's stop the bleeding, right? And to a large extent, you can argue about execution, perfection, etc. Could they have gotten better people? That's up for debate. But they stopped the bleeding. Doesn't mean that patient is still not sick. You get... The patient is still sick. Now it's now, okay, in order for the patient to now be well, you now treat the ailment, which is the investments in productivity enhancing stuff that we talked about.
Yeah.
Right? And you now give them nutrition, give them IV, give them drip, right? Somebody that is recovering from cancer doesn't suddenly jump off the bed and start running Olympics, which is what some people want to see. But the guy, okay, you've cured, you've stopped the bleeding, you've cut the tumor, he's cancer-free, but he's still weak. You need to then re-oil the person, give him drip, give him food. He will go back to the gym, start gymming. Suddenly he has muscle, and then he's back to his Olympic ambition that he used to have before. It's the same journey we are on. But obviously, people are going through it. It is a very painful experience for people. At least I can still buy fuel for my car, right? There are people that can barely eat. We have to be sensitive to that. Things are bad. I've never seen this level of beggars on the street anytime I'm driving in Lagos. I'm scared. Which is why the government needs to channel a lot of the excesses that they are now earning as a result of removal of subsidy into the pockets of people that desperately need this cash. We need more social transfers.
Example.
We need the government to basically create a system.
Because it's always like the government, I'm asking for an example, because what we always see is, you see the headlines, conversations around, oh, we gave 50 million.
But you never see the people.
You never see the people.
Yeah, I don't know. I know World Bank has a program. I know there's a social transfer program that is going on. I haven't seen anybody that have received it personally. So maybe it's because of my income circle. Right? Yeah. But I ask even drivers, people that work with us, and I've not seen. So whether they've politicized it or not, I don't have enough data to speak to that.
Yeah, I get it.
But I think, I mean, we have everybody's, at least everybody has mobile phone.
Yeah, I get.
Through mobile phone data, you will really know the people that are struggling.
True.
Right? There are ways, technology, thank God for technology, we can reach more people than we've ever been able to reach in the past. And I know the government doesn't really have that much cash, but cash is growing, but it's not still a lot enough. But we need to, as a society, create a safety net for our most vulnerable people. While we find a way to channel them into productive activities.
You've worked as an employee.
Yeah.
You, we call you an entrepreneur, both sides. And you've excelled extraordinarily in both sides, on both sides.
I don't like the word extraordinary. Okay. My journey has just started.
Okay, your journey has just
started. That's why, like, when I was actually coming here, I was a bit nervous because I don't want to. It's not victory.
Yeah, right?
It's a journey. Right?
Yeah.
So I can take stock of where I am. I'm proud of where we've gone to, right? But I don't want to say I have big ambitions, because life can happen to you, right? But like, I think the journey is still far. So maybe if we have this conversation when I'm 90 years old, we can start talking about extraordinary achievements. So I have to be cautious of that. Well, we've achieved some level of success, I can say that.
So the question now is, what's the blueprint for succeeding as an employee? You've rose to the rank of a vice president in a global bank. What helped you? How can Nigerian employees, workers, especially in those in finance, how can they succeed?
Yeah, and the honest truth is, in a society, you need mentors and sponsors. I can say I'm a genius, right? Yes, there are many geniuses. Like I said, in my secondary school, I was an above average student. I was not a rock star. Right? And you can argue in university, I got much better, right? I graduated top of my class. But like, the point that I'm saying is, yes, but there are a lot of people like me, right? What made a difference in my life, and I'm just being brutally honest here, is when I got my first job, I had a boss that believed in me. Right? For his own, I don't know what the reason was. And it was tough because, I mean, I worked on a trading floor of 800 people, right? Of the 800 people, there were two black people out of one of two or three, right? So the rest of them were white, privileged, gone to certain types of schools. I went to Federal Government College in Idoani, right? Yes, I went to a good university, an A-level school. But when I compare my privilege to their privilege, I was at a disadvantage. But somebody looked at me and said, this guy is raw, right? Yes, he doesn't know how to use the right fork and knife to eat at dinner, right? But he has potential, right? And he gave me the opportunity to rise. And I didn't disappoint him, right? I remember when I started working at Deutsche, I was an analyst working for him. That year, I think I was one of the few analysts or 75 analysts that was hired out of 20,000 people, right? And of those 75, I was one of the highest paid in my cohort, right? And that's, I mean, I did my job well. It gave me opportunity to be able to, because oftentimes as an analyst, you don't have opportunities to generate revenue. You are largely supporting revenue generators.
Yeah, true.
Right? But my boss from day one said, you must make money for the bank. Right? He taught me how to make the money, but I had to make money. So when it was time to pay me as an analyst, I had revenue to my name.
Yeah.
Right? So from that perspective, when he went into the meeting with his peers to decide who analyzed on, he said, Samson, now my guy, see the money where you make. Bring your own guys. This is what I want to pay him.
So there's no argument.
There's no debate. But that's right. That wouldn't have been possible if I don't have a boss that believed in me.
True.
And he was also the guy that told me that in life, always work for people you respect. Right? And I've carried that throughout my career, right? One of the reasons I came to Nigeria was I moved from Deutsche to Citi, and we had an issue and my bosses changed. And the new guys that were basically running the business, I looked at it, I'm like, I don't see a future in this team. Right? At the time, everybody thought it was madness. You know what it is? To leave a banking job where you're basically managing people that have billions of dollars of capital, right? To come and say, you want to come and do something in Nigeria. Right? So, I mean, like everybody, my father was like, I've worked so hard to send you out of this country and you're coming back. Why?
Village people.
So like, but again, back to your point, in terms of an employee, sponsorship and mentorship are very, very important, right? So for young people, I'm like, find a sponsor. Find a mentor in the area that you want to grow in.
How?
There are different ways to do it. Obviously, like I'm almost
Let's contextualize it in Nigerian. Let's even use banking where you're familiar or investment. Somebody who's working in, you've mentioned GT Bank.
I'll give you an example, like in my career, right?
Yeah.
Because in this life, you need people to promote you all the time. You do. And most of the things that affect your personal promotion, when those decisions get made, you are not in the room. Right? You are not in the room. So how do you then have the ability to influence those decisions? You need to build a network. Right? How did I build a network? Like when I was at Deutsche, like all the senior management people, I felt they liked me because they would always like come to my desk sometimes, ask me questions. If I meet them in the lift, they ask, how do I do that, right? Sometimes, even unrelated to my own business line, there's a senior manager in another team. I can go and meet the guy. Anything I can help you with? Or how can I, given what I do, how can I support your business? Sometimes, most of the time, they will say no. Or they'll say, okay. I'm like, please, can I buy you coffee? Please, can I buy your lunch? Then you sit down, you start talking your own story. They get attached to your own story. When they are making that promotion decision and Samson's name come up, what do you think the guy will say?
The yes have it.
You need to have a personal brand and you need to promote that personal brand. And you need the work, the output to support the brand, though.
Because
there are some people that just brand, but there's nothing behind it, right?
Yeah, true.
Those ones, after a while, you get found out, right? Because people want to be able to say, like, you know, efficient people want to be able to say, I have a problem. Let's say, for the sake of argument, Tony or Jim comes and say, and somebody comes to them and say, I have a problem, this financial problem. and he look at you and say, go to my boy Samson. I have to deliver. For the sake of argument. So you need that content. You need to invest in yourself technically, right? In terms of how you speak to people, you need to do that, right? But again, more than that, you need to invest in your brand. You need to invest in your network. You need to invest. You need to ask yourself, what do you want to be known as? Right? What do you want to be known as? For me, I want to be known as the person that makes a lot of money for my investors by investing smartly, cleverly. Outside of that, I don't want to be known as anything else. That's my identity. That's my brand. So everybody needs to decide what their brand is, right? And then try and market that brand and get people to buy into that brand. You are a business. Life not business. You get what I'm saying? Absolutely. So that's what it is. It's like, again, it's not a magic formula. Some people are lucky. You might be born into the right family. Your father can call somebody. And a lot of that in society happens.
True.
Right? So I'm not trying to dispute that. But over and above that, at least when I worked in banking, I didn't have any father to call anybody. Right? I literally got into banking, luck, intelligence, whatever you call it. But somehow, and this is where luck plays a real role in life, because I could have landed on another desk, right?
Yeah, true.
I could have, and the story would have been very, very different.
Yeah, true.
Right? I remember when I met my boss for the first time, we had a conversation. He said, I like you, come and work for me. Right? That's all.
As an entrepreneur, you invest in a lot of startups.
Yeah.
What are the things you... What's your advice for entrepreneurs? What would you say to them, startup founders, people building businesses in a very, very uncertain economy like that of Nigeria? What would you tell them?
Don't die. If you stay alive, something will happen. Don't die. So what does that mean? Don't risk too much that will lead to your death. Right. You have to obviously focus on ensuring you have a product, right? What is entrepreneurship at the end of the day? Entrepreneurship is the ability to provide a product for somebody at a cost that is lower than the revenue that you make for it. That's what it is. So you need to focus that you're actually, that is what you are doing.
Yeah.
Right. Because sometimes people, especially with this world of startup,
yeah.
Right. I always tell my founders, I'm like, I'm not your customer, I'm an investor. Right. So I find it really odd that you're nicer to me than you are to your customer. Your customer is what makes you sustainable. The day I stop to fund you and you don't have a customer, you're dead. So focus on your customer, right? And the more capital you get from us is a function of how well you're able to serve your customers profitably.
True.
So I would say focus on your customers. Don't die, right? And build step by step. Don't get distracted by $100 million valuation, $200 million valuation, $500 million valuation. At the end of the day, in this life, how much money do we really need? Let's think about it. What is our core need? I want to wear nice clothes. I want to drive nice cars. I want to live in a nice house. How much do these things cost? So don't crash and burn for this unrealistic. It may be realistic. Right. I don't think when Mark Zuckerberg started Facebook, he thought he was going to build what he built. You take it day by day. Even when we started as Rusk, today we basically run a multi-asset investment management company.
What's your AUM?
It's private. I can't disclose.
All right.
But we run a multi-asset asset management company across different asset classes, across different products.
Yeah.
When I came to Nigeria, that was not the initial vision.
Oh, yeah.
But we just started. Look at, again, first principle, what does this market really need? How can we generate sustainable return in this market? And that informed our product development. That informed what we ended up doing. So my own is, start what you want to start. There is, I think it was Mark that said it, Mark Zuckerberg that said, or Jeff Bezos, I don't know, one of them, ideas never come fully formed.
Oh, dear.
Never. Right? Just start. Don't die. Focus on your customer. That's my own advice.
So Africa is ripe. Africa is thriving in context. A lot of people, destination hub for investment is Africa, especially now that
Well, the capital doesn't show that, but it has potential. Okay. It has potential.
Okay. The data, maybe the data doesn't show that, but...
I mean, Asia is outshining us. LATAM is outshining us. So we are still the small kid in the block, right?
Okay, we're still the small kid in the block, but there's this mantra around Africa rise, and...
I think Africa will rise.
Yeah.
In our lifetime, yes.
Yeah. What sector would you say, hey, FDI, go here.
Every sector. Yeah. Every sector.
Which one of them is the most attractive to you if you're advising a potential investor in EM markets like Africa?
I mean, we still have a lot of infrastructure to build, right? So infrastructure sector is interesting. We still have...
But sorry to cut in, but in the context of being specific, I'm saying that because if you chase so many rats, you end up...
No. Losing. So you as an individual needs to be focused on where you... My point I'm saying is that the way Africa is at the moment, if you're a serious executor and you are lucky, luck plays a big role in success, right? I think any sector you will make money. That's my own opinion. Wow. It's hard for me to see a sector where I'm like, you know what? Obviously, some sectors are harder than others. For example, it's easier to build an asset management company today than to build a bank. People have already run that race. For you to now come and build a bank, you need to offer something radically different from what these current banks are doing. So if you wake up tomorrow as an entrepreneur and say, I want to build a bank, I'm not saying you can't succeed, but your high jump is higher. Right. If you wake up today and say you want to build an asset management company, I mean, there are good competitors in the market, but it's still a nascent industry.
Yeah, true.
So, but your high jump is not as, even the process of applying for the license is not as strenuous as it would be for a bank. I see this opportunity in oil and gas with the PIA, right? All of a sudden, everybody can drill at a cost that you couldn't, at a much smaller cost than you used to be before. Because I don't know if you know what the PIA basically does, right? Because what the PIA does, because before banks, oil companies will have these large oil mining licenses and oil prospecting licenses that will cover blocks, oil blocks, and they'll just drill a few holes there. That's where they get to their production, but nobody else can touch the block, right? Under the PIA, the government has said, okay, if you are not drilling, return the thing. Maybe we'll give people win serious. Right.
True.
So now I can go and sit down with you, raise a few million dollars, go to a Shell or a Chevron, raise financing, right? And all of a sudden I'm building another company. This is opportunity that is available to Nigerians. So instead of Nigerians to be complaining and be insulting our politicians, and they deserve the insult, I'm not saying they don't. Right?
Yeah.
But there's a lot that we can do now. This is our country. We are the ones that we have been waiting for, right? Before, I used to be critical of everybody. But these days, when I insult politicians, I go to the mirror, I look at myself, I say, I don't grow. I'm now in a position of relative influence. What am I using that influence to do, to advance society? We all need to be asking those questions.
Sure.
Eventually, the politicians will start to fear. And they will do the right thing. Now, it's lack of consequence that drives these political decisions. Which is why election has to matter.
So you talked about, you gave me a case study just now with using investment banking and banking. Investment banking is a bit nascent compared to commercial banking.
Yeah.
Which other sectors do you think it's relatively untapped?
Insurance. Financial sector is my bread and butter, so I know that sector quite well.
Okay.
Right? Insurance.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, insurance penetration in Nigeria is like 1% of GDP or less, right? Other societies are like tens of percents of GDP. So we haven't tapped that.
Yeah.
Right. I find it very frustrating, right, that a lot of money has just been going into fintech. And all that fintech money has been going into payments. And I keep asking people, I'm like, Nigeria doesn't have a payment problem. Have you ever been able to try to pay by transfer and it didn't work?
No, not at all.
So what are you solving? Why is all the money going there when there are problems across the whole of society that money should be solving?
That's why I'm asking you,
right?
So that you can
again, like, it's very, I don't want to narrow it down because like we, everywhere we look, the problem that we have at Ross is that we don't have enough capital to deploy into the problems that we see across our product vertical. There is too much opportunity. Obviously, Nigeria can happen to it. People can come and frustrate you. People will wait for you to cook the food, and then all of a sudden they will turn up, right? Those things are part and parcel of the operating environment, and you have to kind of be mentally prepared to deal with it on occasion, right? But the reality is, I mean, I'll tell you, like, when I look at my, in terms of to frame, like, the conversation is like, okay, in venture, what are we doing? Within the Nigerian context, right? We're in paid HRO, for example, which is basically building a embedded finance. Well, I don't want to use the word embedded finance, but that's the future. Because, for example, most of Nigerians are unbanked on the asset side. So what I mean is that a lot of people put money in banks. But how many people can collect loan from bank?
Yeah, true.
Right? There's a lot of reasons why, right? And I don't want to go into that. But building embedded banking systems that allow you to use technology to get more data and information about people before you provide financial services for them, right? For me, it's a $1 billion plus opportunity on the continent. So businesses like Paid that is processing payroll, all of a sudden they have data on who is earning what and when and how they spend their money, right? And then all of a sudden they can sell you products. Into that, you can do cross-border, you can invest in financial assets, they can financially educate you on how to manage your money. That is a huge opportunity. Or most of society now is moving into estates. Those estates need to be managed. The moment you put technology on top of those estates, they know how much electricity you are buying. They know when your rent is due. They know how many visitors you are getting. They know when you order seaway water. They know when you go to the groceries. And then you need financial services to pay your rent. And I know that you have the track record to be able to pay it. I will be able to make that loan and do a better recovery than any bank in Nigeria can do. That's opportunity. AI. Huge opportunity. Right? Yes.
But they say in a man which up they use AI.
No. But again, where do you want to play within that value vertical?
Okay.
Right? It is stupid to say that we shouldn't be investing in frontier LLM models.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't make sense. We don't have the money. These guys are burning hundreds of billions of dollars to build, train, and achieve artificial general intelligence.
Yeah.
Right? We are not in that game. Right? It's good to be humble. Take humble pie. Say, okay, where are we? Right? Those models need to feed data. They need to eat data. The data have not been labeled properly on the African continent.
True.
Do you think if somebody builds a startup in one vertical and deliver structured, labeled data to Facebook to train Lambda or whatever they call their AI, do you know how much Facebook will pay for it? Do AI labeling for Yoruba? Do AI labeling for Igbo? Or all that data that we consume, structure it. That's value. You don't need to build frontier LLM model to do it. Another thing with AI, right? I'm just thinking out of the box. Yeah. It's not something I spend a lot of time in. It's AI is very power intensive. At some point, you want to be in jurisdiction that have low power prices and high power capacity. We can build the power capacity given our gas assets, given our coal assets. We can build those data centers that AI need to survive. You don't need to build the model. If I'm able to deliver a data center at a fraction of a cost that it will cost you to deliver a data center in America, they'll come here and do the thing. How can we have that level of gas assets, right? And we don't have cheap electricity. And in my mind, like I always say, like in my mind, electricity should be subsidized. Economic growth is energy transformed. Show me a country that has access to cheap power or cheap energy. I will show you a country that is industrializing. So we really need to think about, and we can deliver, because God has blessed us.
True.
We can deliver cheap electricity. We have the input to deliver it. How in the world do we not have electricity capacity when we are flaring all the gases that we are flaring?
Yeah.
Right. So that's my point. Is like there are areas to look at. There are areas that we can choose to play in and say, okay, what are the big boys doing? What can we do to support what the big boys are doing? Another point I'm making is, we know that costs across the world is rising, right? We still have cheap labor. We have cheap people. We have proximity to Europe. For example, we know Europe doesn't want to buy Russian energy again.
Yeah.
There's conversation to be had. Like, honestly, like, we are supposed to have a permanent delegate in Brussels telling the Europeans that we get gas, so these Russians that are dealing with you people like this, that your industries are you losing competitiveness, come and invest in pipeline. We'll send you all the gas you need, but bring the capital to do it. And again, we don't get Russian nuclear weapons. So if we mess up, you can come and kill us.
Yeah, true.
You know, I mean, I'm not advocating for lack of sovereignty, yeah. But there are conversations, and I'm saying it quite crudely as a politician, you would say it with a bit more finesse, but there are conversations that should be had, that there's a window of opportunity for Africa to leverage on its problems, to leverage on its access. So, for example, I mean, European politicians have swung right. They don't like us. They don't like immigration. They don't like black people. They want everybody to go home. Why don't we have people in Brussels, in Nigerians, in Brussels and London, saying, you want my people back? No problem. We'll take them. But we need them to be doing something at home. So I want you to give me products that I need to produce and make it easy for me to bring those products to you. And those people will come home and do the job. Those conversations need to happen. So, like, there are lots of things that can be done. But the first step, again, is stabilize the bleeding. I really think these guys have done a good job of stabilizing the bleed. Economically speaking, there is nothing that the political opposition, let's ignore corruption. Because people are like, oh, this government is so corrupt. I don't know. Is this government more corrupt than Buhari's administration? It's open for debate, right? But there's no, from an economic standpoint, and I'm speaking, and I need to reiterate that I'm speaking purely from an economic standpoint.
Yeah.
From an economic standpoint, right, what can the opposition, if it's Obi, if it's Atiku, if it's Rotimi Amaechi, and I'm not doubting their capacity.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's anything that they will say they will do that these people haven't done. Maybe you can say they didn't do it well. But I read the manifesto of all three when the election came. All these things that Tinubu have done that they are blaming him for, they were all going to do it.
Because he had no choice.
It had to be done.
Yeah, true.
It had to be done. And this is not an advocate for political choice. Yeah. I'm just speaking from an economic perspective. Yeah.
I get that. It's been a great, great conversation. It's been a great conversation, Samson. Thank you very much. You're welcome. A great, great conversation. What is the next frontier? What sector should we?
I'm bullish on the local equity market.
Local equity market.
Yes, I think we've been through a really difficult time. We are recovering. Like, cost of capital is falling.
Yeah.
Earnings are recovering. So, I think there are lots of sectors in the public market that are interesting.
So, speaking of that, I think it's even interesting for us to unravel the equities market, because there seems to be a lot of campaign for Nigerian Stocks Exchange, for people retail investors to come in. There was a point in time that I almost saw street hawkers literally hawking shares on Third Mainland Bridge with banners, and you see content, you see people, oh, buy the shares, buy the shares, buy the shares, all in the name of meeting up with recapitalization and all that. Mm. What is happening in NGX? Do you think that what's happening in NGX?
I'll give you, Nigeria is a contradiction, right? We are a very young population. You open this conversation saying that the average age is 19.
Yeah.
Right? When you're a very young population, it means that your liabilities, your big liabilities are far into the future.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, true.
So when your liabilities are far into the future, your asset mix should also be far into the future too. Right. So how do you have an asset management industry and a pension industry that has 80% of its assets in treasury security when our liabilities are so long term? There's a mismatch there.
Yeah, true.
I mean, the conversation as to why that is the case, but that doesn't make sense. Right. So obviously equity has risk and people have been burnt.
Yeah.
Right. But the number of people that own equity assets in Nigeria is abysmal, right? Nobody owns this thing. I think when I was launching my fund in September, I think some data that I saw was that there are only 700,000 active CSCS accounts in the whole of Nigeria.
700,000? Yeah. But a CSCS account can have other expression, like a tree, like a pyramid, where they...
No, so
use
every
all equity, these apps.
No, yeah. So every app, so all shares in Nigeria
are
held with the central securities, whatever, the deposit system.
Yeah.
So every share is held through that system.
Very
so you have a CSCS number. That CSCS number is linked to whatever app that you open. So all your shares are consolidated into that CSCS number.
Oh, okay.
So that tells you the individual number of active share participants on a retail basis in Nigeria. Fund 700,000 is abysmally low. Very. Right. The asset management industry have like 2% of their total assets in equities.
2%, which is...
Which doesn't make sense, right?
Even but they're playing safe.
Even the pension fund. Again, like obviously the... The economic environment didn't permit the risk taking, right? Mm. I think we are moving into a regime where the economic environment rewards risk taking better than it has in the past.
Okay.
And within that context, you need to have equity exposure, which is why we basically launched the fund when we launched in September.
And how far has the fund gone?
So since we launched, the fund is up 104%.
104%. That's
And that was because we had a drawdown in August. Before then, we were like 100 and almost 100 and 110 plus percent. We
had a 6% drawdown in August.
Yeah.
My goodness, that's really incredible. Let's touch base on cryptocurrencies. I kind of have an idea that it's not your strong point, but what do you think is the future of crypto? And I'm saying this because we can't neglect it. The government has come. There's a lot of regulation that has come into play. But we have one of the highest adoption in the world.
Right, so, because our currency is crap. Right. So, well, was. It's no longer crap. But our currency was crap.
Okay.
And you couldn't really get access to the dollar or the naira.
Yeah, so it was just...
So crypto was basically a workaround of that system, right?
Laundering.
Yeah, well, some of this is legitimate business. Okay, I know people who use crypto to conduct legitimate business.
Yeah.
Right? Obviously, there will always be bad actors. Bad actors who always take advantage of new technology.
True.
It's not Nigeria, it's global, right? Yeah. I have small crypto exposure personally through a fund, right? But it's not something that I have spent a lot of intellectual horsepower trying to understand.
Mm.
The reason being that during COVID, I tried to, and the team passed my power. Right. I went, you sit down, I attended conferences. I attended all these virtual conferences. Everybody there, PhD, MIT, Harvard, PhD, cryptography, physics, maths. And when they are explaining what they are doing to you, your head cannot catch it. So I'm just like, you know what? Let me just give small money to somebody that I know can follow these people and have a bit of exposure. So that's what we did.
Okay.
There are areas of crypto that I think is really exciting. So for example, the way capital moves around globally is through a system called SWIFT, right? It's a system that was built a long time ago when you didn't have this level of digital connectivity.
Yeah.
Antiquated system, right? It's like not fit for purpose.
True.
Like this idea of on-chain, off-chain, on-ramping, centralized crypto blockchain that allow you to move capital fast across the world, I think crypto is probably, from what I've seen, the best solution to solve that issue. Mm-hmm. How it gets solved, I don't know, right? But having stable coins, right, that allow you to settle your supplier in two minutes in China, as opposed to waiting for the US to open so that your correspondent bank can accept your instruction before they debit you, I think that system is no longer efficient, right?
That's right.
So I think crypto... For me, that's a big use case for crypto that I see is going to get developed over the coming years and decades. The part that I really, really struggle with is this idea of crypto being an investment asset class, right? Mm. I struggle with that because the fact that it is a currency, right? Like that asset class, or like they'll say Bitcoin is a safe haven. I'm like, safe haven when they lose person money. How is that really a safe haven? You get what I'm saying? Because you can lose money and you can make money on these things. Or the way people will just come and say Bitcoin is going to 1 million. And I try and understand, okay, why? And nobody gives me a really good, strong reason. So I'm skeptical of the concept of crypto as an asset class or as a currency, right?
But as a tech.
But as a technology, I think given my relatively weak knowledge, I have been able to find utility in cross-border payments.
Samson, it's just been I don't know what to say. I don't know the word to use. But one thing I'm just going to say is thank you. Thank you for demystifying all the excesses in the financial system. And the financial world is filled with a lot of, I think I read an article and the article was talking about how it's intentional. Some of the words that are used in finance to hide a lot of information in secrecy. Yeah, that's how I'm going to put it. To hide a lot of information in secrecy so that it's just exclusive to a few. And I love how you just come to unravel, open that Pandora box and people have a lot of insights into the world of finance. And you live in finance inside out. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Do you see yourself becoming the CBN governor someday?
I don't. I have zero interest in politics.
Is it political?
I have. Again, in this. Oh, let's put
if
it.
If I become a president and I say, oh, I once had an interview with a formidable investor, I want you to come.
It's too early. At the moment, I have a commitment to my LPs and my investors to help them generate returns in Nigeria. That's my current focus. If in the future, I'm always, one of the reasons I engage in this and I do drinks and mic is that I want, and my team has basically advised that we'd contribute to the economic conversation in the country.
Yeah.
Right? We need to elevate the economic consciousness of the country. So that's one of the reasons why I'm, as crazy as it sounds, I'm very camera shy.
Yeah.
I don't want people to know my business, right? But like, I think this is my own way of basically trying to contribute to the conversation. I'm accessible. I can offer my advice, or I can put you in contact with people that I think might be able to help you at this stage of my life. What happens in the future, I don't know. One thing I know is that I have unwavering faith in the ability of Nigerians to overcome the problem of Nigeria. I've always been positive on Nigerians. I've had issues with Nigeria, right, that I hope we solve, right? But as Nigerians, if we put our head together and we work, right, there's a reason why the Brits didn't want to let us go.
Oh.
There's a reason why. And we need to reawaken that reason. We used to be a proud people. Right? I'm a Benin man. I know what empire did. I'm proud of that heritage, right? I read what the Dutch or the Portuguese wrote about my ancestors. My shoulders are high. Today, Benin can stand where Holland or Portugal is standing. That's a shame. And as custodians of that legacy, we should be disappointed in ourselves.
So, it's a lot to take in. I'm going to rewatch this. I'm going to put it on repeat, on repeat, on repeat, on repeat, because it's like therapy. Yes, exactly. It's like you just opened up something that there's a reason, actually. And if we dig down into that reason, then therein lies our strength.
Yeah.
Therein lies our strength.
It's what gives me hope. I don't see our situation as hopeless. Otherwise, I won't be here. I will be an MD in London, earning a good salary.
It looks like we're going to have a part two. we're really going to have a part two, because this is a lot to take in. This is a lot to take in. And I have a confession. I really struggled pronouncing your son name, but I'm going to try.
Yeah.
You notice that I avoided it.
Yeah.
Esemwede.
Well, that's kind of the anglicized one, and usually what a lot of people, but the real pronunciation in Benin is Esemwede. a same word there. That means no amount of sacrifice can stop time.
No amount of sacrifice can stop time.
Yeah.
But quite unfortunate, we have to stop time at this point in time. It's been a great conversation. You've heard, we touched base with different aspects of money, economy, and finance, investing, the African economy, capital flight, GDP. You heard it all from Sansin Esemwede. Right?
Same way. Yeah, well done.
It's been a great conversation. Thank you very much for coming to the Frankly Business Podcast. We would love to have you some other time.
Sure.
Maybe have a part two that might be time bound, maybe something major happening in the economy, and just for you to break it down for a lot of people to understand. Thank you very much. I'll see you on the next one. Make sure you like, subscribe, share. If they want to reach out to you, where can they?
But you can go on my website,
okay.
www.zross.com, and you can reach out, my first name, my surname at zross.com if you want to reach out to me personally.
Mm.
If you need information on our investment products, investments at zross.com.
Cut soup for me, cut soup. I don't cut down for you. You don't hear. If you're in the startup ecosystem, hey, don't blink. Just go straight and hit him and shoot your shot. You never can tell. You just might be the person who validates their investment thesis. And you might end up getting a few investment from Zwax. I'll see you on the next one. Like, share, subscribe, and keep educating, keep elevating the African business landscape. Cheers.
Thank you.